you're out in the wild for a while. So that really helps bond people together. And at the end of that year, after you graduate, you're a senior fellow, and then you continue to work in the community and do what you do. So really the impetus from this, I have to give credit to my wife, Naomi Fine. When she got out of the program a couple of years ago, she said, well, you know, I just went through this program, but what are we going to do around the issues that are most important to us? And I had actually grown a little bit disenchanted because the organization is not political, and I wasn't feeling like I could really be impactful in the way I wanted. And so we gathered a group of people. We created an LGBT and allies network on the site. People could join or not join. And then we started to put together a group and said, let's talk about what we could do to create a better environment in Silicon Valley and the nation for LGBT people. We came together in discussion and ultimately decided to make a film. So that's just what we did. Everybody who you see in the film, it's a 38-minute documentary, everybody who you see in the film has to be an ALF fellow, meaning they're going through the program now, or a senior fellow. So if you're wondering why these people, that is the only shared characteristic. And what we tried to do is invite people who represented different communities, whether it's people of faith, whether it's the business community, the educational community, as well as people with different ethnic backgrounds, people with different religious backgrounds, because we wanted it to reflect the community. So without further ado, I'm going to show you the film, and then we'll have a chance to talk about it more afterwards. The last thing I would just like to say is that we worked very hard to not make it an advocacy piece, that it was meant to foster dialogue and be a tool that could be the impetus for conversation in any number of formats. So that was the foundation on which this was built. And the filmmaker is actually a professional filmmaker, the director, and he happens to be an ALF senior fellow as well. So that was really great. Here we go. And I understand we can't turn the lights off, so I apologize for that.
Why is marriage equality such an issue in America?
Many people don't know that there are more than 400 state rights in California that a legally married couple in California can have access to. And at a federal level, there are more than 1,100 rights that no gay couples have access to, even those couples who are legally married in the state of Massachusetts or in the state of California. Nobody has access to any of those 1,100 rights. And they affect our day-to-day life in the most basic and the most profound ways.
The fact that I don't have the right in the state I grew up in to be married in a loving relationship with the person that I adore and to celebrate that without any interference. It's sad, some rage. And yet, I still maintain some compassion for the people who think they're doing right by stopping me, and I just stay hopeful that they will hear something, see something, experience something that will remind them that we are the same.
My first interactions with people from the gay community occurred when we were starting our business back in 1982. One of our very early employees was a young man who was gay, and found very quickly that that was totally irrelevant to his ability to do his job, and it was absolutely meaningless in terms of our decisions about whom to hire. And so over the years, a fair number of people from the gay community have been part of Adobe's story. They've come and gone. Many of them have been extremely successful. But from my point of view, it became a non-issue very quickly.
The first time I became aware of someone being gay or understanding the concept of that was growing up in high school. My family and another family were friends. My parents were friends with another couple, and they had kids. And this one individual was several years older than I was, and he graduated from high school and went to college and moved out of the house. And I had heard that he moved out of the house and went to San Francisco, and the family had severed ties with him. And I had found out afterwards that it was because he was gay and the family was not accepting. And it was the first time I came into contact with someone I knew that was gay, and I was the first time I was familiar with the concept of being gay and what that meant in my community.
The word gay or lesbian never came up in our home as a child growing up in Colorado. That was just something that was never brought up and never really thought about. So my first experience was actually out after my college years, where a young lady had come out to me. I was in college, she was in high school, and she came out to me, and that was the very first experience that I had of meeting someone that at that time thought was very different from me. And I know that I really felt her pain, her fear of coming out to someone who at that moment in time was her youth leader in an evangelical Christian youth movement. And I remember just having my heart just feel that it was pounding out of my chest as she began to use the word gay, and then use the word lesbian, and have my own sense of fear come out about just my unknowingness about that topic, but feeling a total commitment to love her and to allow her to be exactly who she was in my presence, and really being honored as being one to be a part of her journey of beginning that process of saying who she was authentically.
So my first experience was my older brother, who was gay and very close, my closest brother. I'm a bit emotional about it because the end of the story is that he passed away from AIDS, right, 94. It was, I had come out to the Bay Area to basically be with him, and stayed out here and worked and things, but I miss him dearly.
The first time I'm aware was an argument in my home between my mother and my stepfather, where she outed him in our home, and that was the first time that I really started thinking, well, what is this and what's happening here?
I grew up in the black community, grew up in the civil rights movement, and often in the African American community especially, you don't talk about the fact that there are black or lesbian, gay or lesbians. That's something that you don't miss. So the first time I had experience with it, I tell folks a very interesting story, is I actually grew up thinking that only white people were gay or lesbian because black people weren't gay or lesbian. So it's until I went to college, that's where I actually learned that. So I remember going back to my mom. She says, "Well, we didn't have any black or we didn't have any gays in our family." But then I was like, "Okay," but then you look back at it and you look back at the church experience, my experience in church, and then going back from where I was growing up in church and then seeing where we are now, we obviously had, there was a lot of gays and lesbians directly in our church. We went to one of the largest churches on the east side in San Jose. So in terms of my experience, I was surrounded with folks, but never knew.
The subject of marriage equality, of anyone being able to marry the person that he or she chooses, is an issue that came to me actually when I was on the bench, and it really came to my attention more forcefully than ever when I got a phone call. And I got a phone call from a young woman who I'd known for quite a while, who, this was before the Supreme Court's decision on gay marriage, same-sex marriage, who said to me, "My partner and I want to get married. Will you perform this wedding?" So you have to understand, this was before we had any kind of weddings going on, and they wanted to do it anyway. And I said yes. And after I said yes, I stepped back and said, "Now, what am I doing? I mean, what is this? It's not legal. There's really nothing here to say that this is other than we're just kind of going through the motions." And then I thought about it more and said, what they're doing is taking a stand about what they believe and what I believe to be right, and really went to someone who had, even though I have the official power, the official authority and power to perform weddings, I had none under the law in California, even though I was a judge. But I went ahead anyway, and we had this wonderful wedding, and I presided over it and watched these two very brave young women who are still together and with their two children. And it's that really, I think more than anything else, really brought home to me the importance of doing what they did, and the importance of saying to everyone, this is a right, this is a civil right, and it's something to which I'm entitled just because I'm here.
On the day that Gavin Newsom in San Francisco declared that he would begin marrying same-gender couples, we didn't go to San Francisco during that brief window, but I remember weeping openly that night watching the newscasts and feeling that perhaps in my lifetime, something that would change the course of history would happen, and that our journey could include the possibility of being married. And when the state Supreme Court said that same-gender couples could now be married in the state of California, my partner, who is a teacher, I knew all day, had no access to media coverage, so I knew she wouldn't have heard about it. And I left work early that day to meet her, and to meet her at, in our home that we had built. And after 25 years of being in a faithful, loving, committed relationship together, asked her if she would marry me.
I've been together with my partner since I was 28, and we were very thrilled, we were very elated, and we wanted to be part of this. We felt this was our civil rights moment in time. And we went to City Hall. I remember Gavin Newsom declared it to be legal in the city of San Francisco on Wednesday, and I think on Saturday, if I'm correct, it was Valentine's weekend. And we went to City Hall, and we waited an hour, and we waited in line for 3 hours, along with hundreds of other gay couples, to exercise our right to get married.
Finally, for us to be able to say, like heterosexual couples, we can stand before our friends and family and say that we choose to belong to each other for the rest of our lives was radically different for us and was important beyond what I had ever comprehended. And I think in many ways it was like being surprised by joy.
I've always believed that gay people, lesbians, transgender, bisexual, queer, straight people should have the same rights. And that's, I've always believed that since I have been a teenager. Marriage equality wasn't an issue back then. Gay rights was the issue back then when I was a teenager. And a lot of us feminists did not believe in the institution of marriage, period, for anybody. But now I believe that it's important that everybody have the right to marry, because without that right, you will always have a second-class citizenship.
As I've grown older and have a family and realize how daily not having the right to be legally married puts me and my family at risk, it has not only accelerated my view, but it has made it that much stronger and that much more urgent for me in my life.
Many of us in the gay and lesbian rights movement have realized that the end goal is marriage equality, that if we can have acceptance of our relationship in a legal and societal way, that really means that there would be an acceptance of gays and lesbians that we've never really had before, and that we deserve all the other rights that everybody should have. But it has been long in coming, and just you can see the struggle that has ensued with us asking for it.
As an African-American woman, having an experience myself in the civil rights movement and having parents for whom the civil rights movement really shaped, their very existence, I think that in my own mind and in my own experience, I've been one who value justice for all, and I think that marriage equality is just and right.
HR is one of the groups that I run at Cisco, and as the head of the community of employees at Cisco, I feel like this is a basic right that they should have. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding that equal rights is very different than marriage. And if you look at the complications of the number of laws, entitlements, benefits that are tied to the concept of marriage, that to think they can fix it through this equalization, I think, is very naive, quite frankly. And price is a huge burden on a small minority that I can't quite figure out what the downside is.
Well, as the topic of gay marriage has become something that's discussed widely and often with great passion, I began to realize that the point of view that many people had was totally unfounded and unfair. And part of it is probably colored by the social convention of this country, in that many people are married in a religious environment, in a church by a minister or a priest, rabbi. And the irony is that in most of the Western world, particularly in Europe, the legal relationship that is part of marriage and the religious aspect of it are completely separated. The legal ceremony typically in Western Europe happens on the day before any kind of religious ceremony, and some people choose to have a religious ceremony associated with the marriage once it's been legally defined, and some do not. But in this country, since we've given ministers and priests the authority to do marriages, I think in the social mind of this country, they're somehow coupled. And from my point of view, it's just a question of fairness in terms of the rights of two people who decide to cohabitate and build a life together, that they have the ability to have the same kind of access to health care, the same kind of financial prerogatives that are available to heterosexually married people. And it just makes no sense to me that we've allowed this to become such a major issue when I think it's really a non-event. If you particularly, I want to emphasize, if you take the religious aspects out of it.
The process of becoming married in California means you go to your county clerk's office and you pay money, and the clerk determines whether or not you're married to anybody else at that time, and if you're old enough to get married without your parents' permission. Assuming all that is satisfied, you get a license, and you take that license to someone who will marry you. As I said, I don't marry people I don't know, so I would turn down strangers. Every religious organization has that same right.
Interesting. Okay.
And I think we have a tendency to color this whole issue and not look at the basics. The right is to have a piece of paper that entitles you to be recognized as a married couple. And I think everybody ought to have that right.
What we're talking about here really is civil marriage.
And each religious group will make its own decision about what they embrace and what they don't embrace. So this isn't about imposing something that violates people's religious freedom or individual conscience. This is about civil liberties. This is about governmental structures and equal rights. And people will do what they feel right within their own religious communities. I know people were very frightened at the time of Prop 8 that this is going to impose something on them. I think every religious tradition will, I hope eventually they'll all come round, but each one will come round in their own time and in their own way. And to remember that this is about civil marriage, this is about civil rights, this is about visiting in the hospital, this is about income tax, this is about a lot of very practical things that make a real difference in people's lives.
I am a Muslim, I'm a devout Muslim, and in our faith, homosexuality is not accepted. Having said that, living in the United States, I firmly believe that this country accepts everybody. The diversity of this country is like no other. And therefore, I myself am a minority. I'm a religious minority. I'm an ethnic minority. And so I have learned to value diversity, value the fact that there are people with different beliefs, different lifestyles, and they are all valuable. They all contribute to society. And therefore, I have learned, I learned very early on that the strength of America was its diversity. And that included gender, sexuality, race, religion. And so I now am proud to say I have some very close gay friends. I realize I have gay relatives. And while that lifestyle may not be for me, for who I am and for my faith, I completely accept and celebrate my friendships and relationships with people who are different than I am.
I am a religious person. I'm a Roman Catholic, and I believe very much in the message of Jesus Christ, who, as near as I can tell, hung out with all sorts of people.
I am a religious leader, I'm a rabbi, and I am glad to have this opportunity to talk about that because I know religion is used so often as a wedge in this issue. And I think it's important for people to understand that there are many different religious points of view and that people are taking the Bible in a sort of simplistic way when they use it to oppose marriage equality. There is a verse in Leviticus that speaks about a man should not lay with a man as with a woman. But I think there are a couple of things about that that we need to understand. First, that in that section of the law, there are many other things that we don't observe today. And that's not just because we're non-observant, but because of the nature of that law. And certainly for Christians, since the time of Paul, they have abrogated that law and said that following that law is not necessary to religious salvation. So I find it kind of strange that people isolate that one rule in the Bible and use that to oppose marriage equality. I also personally think that we need to look at the message of the Bible and of our religious traditions as a whole. And the first opening chapter of the Bible is meant to remind us that each of us, every human being, is created in the image of God. And that has to include everyone in the world, and that has to include people of different races and different orientations, and that's what it really means to be in the image of God. So there's an honor that we owe to all of God's creations, and to me, that's the religious point of view on marriage equality.
Over the years, I have become friends of many same-sex couples, and I observe that they have the same passion and love and caring and tenderness as opposite-sex couples. And it troubled me immensely that they were not in a position where they could be open about their relationship, where they could have a legal standing about their relationship. So as I said, in my view, it was a matter of fundamental unfairness.
I have some friends that are in just the greatest loving relationships, and they're gay or lesbian. And if I could have that kind of relationship or fall in love with someone in that deepness, wow, what a gift.
Those committed relationships lead to stability in the society. They lead to children growing up who are stable, who are secure, who are happy. And how can that not be good for any society? So my opinion is any stable, committed relationship is good.
I think the attitude of separating one category of parent from another category of parent does a real disservice to the children. And I have observed so many thriving homes of many different combinations. And to deprive them of the nurture and the recognition that they are a family is inhuman.
When, and I don't say if, when marriage equality comes not just to California but to this country, I really don't expect to see anything dramatic happen at all. In other words, this whole thing, and when I say this thing, marriage equality, to those who oppose it, see it as this huge thing that's going to be horrible and, you know, the world's going to end if this ever happens. And what will happen, of course, is the world will not end, the sky will not fall, and what will happen is that life will go on as if nothing else changed, which is exactly what happened when eventually schools were integrated and, you know, little black kids could go to school with white kids. Nothing happened. People are like, after a while, like, what in the world was the big deal?
Getting through that issue, I think, lets us as a society go deal with all of the other latent issues that are around belief systems, lifestyle choices, just, you know, do you belong or fit in or follow the group? And that's an essential step, I think, along this arc of our society of understanding rights and to get to this place where the majority does protect the rights of the minority.
Allowing same-sex couples to have legal civil marriage makes possible that this country hold true to its promise. It makes possible that we don't make exceptions to justice and equality for all and the pursuit of happiness and those kinds of things that we have founded this country on. It makes it that we don't lie in the case of lesbian, gay, and bisexual, and transgender people, because right now that promise is a lie for a certain segment of people.
The pursuit of happiness is always about a person. It's about finding a person to share life with. And if our laws would change so that every human being has that right to find their path towards happiness, then I think the planet becomes a totally different place.
Our country has always been a leader in giving people rights and eventually realizing that prejudice actually destroyed the common good as opposed to protected people in their prejudiced positions.
It's not going to take care of everything. It's not going to make, you know, people's stereotyping or their bias or their discriminatory actions against people. It's not going to make that go away. What makes those things go away is getting to know people as people instead of just knowing people by who or what they are. And so we still, even in this community, are going to have a lot of work to do, even after the day when all people are allowed to marry, regardless of orientation.
I think when our federal government recognizes the right of same-sex couples to marry, there'll be so many more children who are safe and stable and taken care of. There'll be so many more people who won't be wards of the state or of the government because they'll be able to rely on the life insurance or Social Security benefits of their respective spouses. There'll really be an opportunity to be able to feel what it's like to live in a society where people are treated equally and where there's not an otherness.
I think two things would happen. One is that the next generation of kids would grow up with a new norm. And once that norm becomes part of who they are and how they see the world, I think we'll have a huge cultural shift. That kind of integration, I think, is really the next generation's work. Our gift is to be able to institutionalize that under the law in order for them to grow up in that kind of environment. And I think, secondly, it would allow gay and lesbian kids growing up with a new model of what their life could be about and what their trajectory could be about. So in adolescence, for example, you would not have this kind of stunting and retardation that we do to kids, gay lesbian kids today. We have the highest suicide rates among gay teens. Why? Because we don't have a healthy sexual development for kids, both emotionally and spiritually in that way. I think that really opens up those possibilities that kids could grow up who may be gay or lesbian or questioning. They would grow up in a very with a different set of models that are much healthier for a real integration in their lives. It's just really a very difficult process today.
I'm living with a son who experienced 3 years the greatest pain before he come out. It was his freshman, sophomore, and junior year of high school. And high school is hard enough to struggle to come out. I think he's much more comfortable now with his new identity, the identity he always had. But he was just sharing with me on the way, taking me back from school, is that, my whole view of life is based on a closet gay teen. And I just was thinking, my experience with Catherine, going through it with her, not knowing, and she not knowing. And then the latest one is my son, who I live with, and I see their pain and their struggle. And I said, why? My daughter, who going to puberty, doesn't have the same struggle as my son. It's the same thing, awakening to their own sexuality. Why is so unjust?
We won't have people suffering so much, as I have seen both young people suffer, even when their parents will accept them, but they still suffer because they worry that their parents won't accept them. Or older people suffer because a spouse has come out or because they're going to come out and they're going to cause pain and suffering to other family members. But I think if people can be who they are throughout their lifetime, we can avoid a lot of needless suffering.
We all benefit when there's the affirmation of a loving relationship. It means that we are a healthier society. It means that we are enabling more love in the world. It means that we are allowing people to take responsibility for being in a loving partnership, meaning taking care of each other in health and in sickness, for richer or for poorer, to really support those kinds of relationships. Helps our whole society to be stronger and more loving.
If in this country we accept a particular group as a minority, they may not be following the lifestyle or beliefs as the majority, but we accept them. We do not criminalize them. Therefore, as a minority, they must have the same rights as everybody else.
Any cultural change like we're going through here, I think, creates angst and perturbation in people. But if we look back, I mean, honestly, the country's had we only had the civil rights in the 60s. We had slavery until the late 1800s. It's only been, in 1950, you couldn't do interracial marriages in half the states in this country. And I'm not talking about blacks and whites. I'm talking about American Indians and whites, Asians and whites. So I think we have to look ourselves in the eye and say, is this just another tipping point for the country, and that the agita that people are feeling is just the fear of change? Because if you look at the pros and cons of this conversation, the pros are pretty dramatic, and the cons, quite frankly, are a little faulty.
I think that those of us who are for equality in marriage have a lot of work to do in terms of educating, supporting, and advocating, and bringing on board a number of people who are on the sidelines right now.
I think as I become more mature in my own spirituality, in my own profession, in my own personal psyche, I realized that we had a more obligation, and more obligation is not always comfortable. Being neutral doesn't bring about great change.
I think we have to hold ourselves accountable for recognizing that change like this happens through persistence, and that those of us who can be vocal and can be supportive have to be vocal and have to be supportive, or we're never going to make the change happen.
I firmly believe that when any group is denied a basic civil right, that it is incumbent upon everyone to work to make the system do better, to correct that. It's a wrong. It is basically that denial of a civil right is a wrong. And those that do nothing, those who say, well, I'm neutral, I'm just going to pass on it, are as much a part of the problem as those who are out there in the streets trying to keep us from attaining that civil right. So I think it's incumbent upon everyone to do your part. And if your part is merely speaking up when, let's say, you're out on the golf course and you hear somebody make this homophobic remark, you hear somebody say something negative about marriage equality, to speak up and say something. For me, that is as heroic as the people who are out on the front lines picketing. Meaning, being heroic for me is when you are hesitant to speak, when there's pressure on you to be silent, and you push through it and speak, that means you're being courageous. And in my book, you're being heroic. And we need more people at every level to be heroic on this issue. And if that were to happen, we will attain marriage equality sooner than later.
My name is Chuck Teschke. I'm the chairman of the board of Adobe Systems. I am a heterosexual man. I have a family, 3 children, 7 wonderful grandchildren, and I've been married for 45 years. And I firmly believe in the rights of all individuals in this country to have the freedom of choice in how they live their lives and what their lifestyles are. And I support that lack of prejudice against people from any kind of background.
I'm Pat Mitchell, and I am an executive director of a nonprofit organization in the community. And I support same-gender marriage and hope that someday that right will be afforded to all people.
I'm Andrew Vu. I'm an assistant general counsel at SAP. I'm legally married to my husband, and I strongly believe in the right for same-gendered couples to marry.
My name's Karen Rudolph, and I believe in marriage equality. I think it's time that all of us have the freedom to choose the family and the partner that we want to have.
My name is Javier Campos, and I strongly believe that same-gendered couples should have equal rights to marry.
I'm Naomi Fine. I'm the CEO of an intellectual property firm. And I believe that having equality in the legal right to marry is an imperative to a healthy society.
I am Greg Papadopoulos. I am a citizen of our community, and I believe with my heart and my soul that we need to collectively get through this marriage equality issue and really support it.
I'm Fred Ferrer. I'm the CEO of the Health Trust, and I'm a gay man. And I believe in marriage equality because I think it's a matter of justice. And until we have justice for all, we really don't have justice for anyone.
I'm Melanie Aaron. I'm a heterosexual. I'm a reform rabbi, and I am for marriage equality.
My name is Randy Pond. I'm the Executive Vice President of Operations, Processes, and Systems here at Cisco Systems. I'm a married man, married for 28 years with two children, and I believe marriage equality is a fundamental right in society, and it's something all of us should be striving for.
So, Roland, would you like? I just closed about the filmmaking. It was made about a year and a half ago. We've shown it at various Commonwealth clubs, Rotary clubs. Encourage people to share it at churches, at their work, at their gym, places where they can have a group of people. We've also made a 17-minute version of it so that some people who have an hour staff meeting can get it into that kind of format. So, our goal was really to create a tool and. That's it.
Okay. Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Roland Stringfellow, and I, going off what the video said, the young man who said that he didn't know that you could be black and gay. I am a gay man, so let me just get that clear. Out in the open. And what I do, and I know many of you are not familiar with me, and but I am proud to say that over the last several years here in the Bay Area, when you have seen many people with clergy collars, people of faith involved with marriage equality, that the Coalition of Welcoming Congregations has been a large part behind that. And so what I would like to talk to you about briefly is just this whole concept of sacred activism. And that is what we label what we do. And but before I really jump into that, I thought I would begin just by simply telling you how I got involved with marriage equality. I've been working heavily in this area since 08, right before the election, November election when Prop 8 was passed. And when I came into this position as guiding the efforts of the Coalition of Welcoming Congregations, I had a very very sharp learning curve because I was coming from Indiana and having to organize communities of faith around marriage equality. Well, we don't have marriage equality in Indiana. So what do I needed to do? And so the interesting thing was this. When Prop 8 passed, and I was out doing a lot of work, you know, within the community, reporters started calling because Prop 8, well, you had an African-American in the White House. Prop 8 had passed, and people of faith were being scapegoated. So who was that black gay minister who is out about? Let's get him. Maybe he has something to say. And so because of that, you know, that really thrusted me even more so into the freedom to marry and the standing up for the rights of others. And so I was very pleased to do that. And but also let me just say that shortly after the passage of Prop 8, there was a huge event in Los Angeles called the Equality Summit, or Equality Forum, I believe. And Molly McKay, many of you know Molly McKay with Marriage Equality USA, she spoke up and gave voice to many of the frustrations that many of us felt during the campaign, that we felt shut out, our voices were not heard, we were not invited to the table when it came to making choices and decisions, particularly around people of color and people of faith. And so to listen to Molly speak about that, that really resonated with me. And I got the coalition even more so involved with the efforts, particularly not only in the Bay Area, but statewide. Now, my comments, I don't mean to say that before I got involved, there were no people of faith involved with marriage equality or even people of color, because I would be remiss if I didn't mention the work of California Faith for Equality, which is L.A.-based, and Andrea Shorter, many of you know her, with Bayard Rustin Coalition. So, again, there were people of faith and people of color who were involved. However, the strategy we use post the passage of Prop 8 were to make sure that when we had public rallies, that A, you're going to see people of faith in the forefront, and B, you're going to see families and people of color in the forefront. And I'm very proud to say we've been able to accomplish that really 09, 10, 11, and recently on the steps of the Ninth Circuit Court when the justices upheld Judge Walker's decision that Prop 8 is unconstitutional. So, again, very, very proud to have all these individuals who normally have been shut out to bring, make sure that they're there. We try as much as possible to have families and children on the forefront, but of course many of these rallies take place during the day, so kids are in school, but nonetheless. So the Coalition of Welcoming Congregations, what is that? And it is an organization made up of over 200 congregations that are welcoming, that practice inclusion throughout the 9-county area of the Bay Area. So you have synagogues and churches and Buddhist sitting groups and even individuals who identify in none of those groups, who maybe identify as Hindu or pagan, but they believe because of their faith that this is the reason why they stand up for marriage equality. And so this whole concept of sacred activism, as I mentioned before, the Coalition, we help congregations around best practices of inclusion. But for those who already take that next step, because we recognize that people of faith, there's a wide spectrum of activity. You have those who are pacifists, and you're not going to see them out on the streets particularly, and those who, again, who are in your face in the streets, and everyone in between. So, again, this whole concept of sacred activism, we really like to say it is your public witness to the world. When you hear people, people of faith, that phrase, or particularly those who are Christian, you know, normally there's a default mechanism that goes in. It's like, okay, clearly then you are in the conservative camp. And, you know, because that's, you know, that's what primarily you see on television. So for those who are progressive, where is our voice in the public square? And that's what sacred activism actually does. It's helping primarily progressive people of faith to come and say, the reason why I'm standing up for immigration is because of my faith, or the reason why I'm standing up for, you know, bullying in schools and make sure our kids are safe is because of my faith. And clearly marriage equality is no different to that as well. The Coalition, we have had some very successful outreaches. I wanted to say briefly one about within a Mormon ward in Berkeley not too long ago. Actually, I should probably have said that because you may be able to figure out who it was. But because it was a closed session, after the scapegoating of Mormons and Catholics, I was approached by leaders of a particular ward that said, you know, would you mind coming and hosting a forum for our congregation? We don't want to open it up to everybody, but again, many of us are hurting and reeling from this, and would you come? I was like, absolutely, because that's one of the things that we do with the Coalition is not just, you know, organize with faith communities, but we do that organization through education and workshops and so forth. So we invited a variety of couples, some of faith, some of no faith, but each of them spoke about why marriage mattered to them. Briefly, after that forum was over, a mother came up to me and said, with tears in her eyes, that I now know, listening to your panel and the words that you had to say, Reverend Stringfellow, that I can love not only my church, but my gay son. And so that then spread to other wards, and we haven't had a form quite like that one. But nonetheless, that is something that we intentionally do, is to speak in the language of people of faith in ways that really gets at the heart of the matter of what this is. So I would like to spend some time talking about, well, what are the strategies when you are working with a religious community? And going back to getting at the heart of the matter, one of the things that we talk about is that, you know, particularly when you may have heard people talk about that we're trying to come up with opposition for a conservative religious arguments. And someone said to me, it's like, oh, you mean the Bible when you say conservative religious arguments, because that's the only, you know, true word that's out there is the Bible, the Bible. And, you know, again, speaking very in kindness that, you know, there are a variety of perspectives when it comes to faith in general or religion in general, and particularly when it comes to Christianity. But the Coalition of Welcoming Congregations, which, by the way, is a program of the Center for Lesbian Gay Studies, which is found on the campus of Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, we have targeted these types of arguments that come up. And the way to do it is really using heart language. Because, again, a colleague of mine, her name is Caitlin Ryan. She's done a lot of spectacular research on working with families who have gay children, or gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer children. And one of the things that she's found and we've incorporated into our work is that when you have a parent who wants to show tough love to their child once they come out of the closet, and they may feel that, you know, by keeping them away from friends, telling them that they're, you know, God is going to punish them, that honestly, as they're doing this, these parents are doing it because they're doing it out of love. Many of us who may feel like, you know, what? You know, how is that love? But they are really trying to approach this in the best way that they know how. So when you're working with people of faith, it's really good to understand that, again, they're coming from this place of thinking and believing that they're doing the right thing. That's why a parent might, you know, inadvertently condemn a child. But when we're speaking with parents or speaking with people of faith, it's like, you know, the first place to begin is, we know you love your child. Yes, I do. So first of all, you have an agreement there. When you speak to your child in these ways, do you realize that really you're not helping them, but really causing more harm and damage? And then you speak to them about that, really what we're talking about, this is life and death. These are life and death issues that are on the line here. And so, again, this is not about, you know, my child doesn't want to follow my faith tradition and now I'm freaked out and I'm going to do everything to try to rope them back in. Is that, you know, this is a part of their core being. And speaking in ways that helping them understand, like, okay, I kind of get this, but I need to hear a little bit more. So another strategy we use is helping them to understand the difference between the love of the law versus the letter of the law. When we say the law, that is the sacred text, whatever faith tradition is used. But oftentimes, when you are focused on the letter of the law, you're being very legalistic. You know, that's when one obeys the law that's there, but completely skipping over the love, you know, the true intent that's supposed to be there. And helping them understand that that type of logic is really condemned. To put the letter of the law above the love that exists. I would like to read a passage, if I have time, that gives an example of what this is. And this really has convinced a lot of people, because then they can now see, like, ah, I get it. I see what you're saying. This is from the New Testament, Mark chapter 3, and this is about Jesus Christ. It says, another time Jesus went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal the man on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, stand up in front of everyone. Then Jesus asked, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save a life or to kill a life? They remained silent. He looked around them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts and said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out and it was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. And this is a particular passage that many Christians who are very dogmatic about, you know, but the word says this and the Bible says that. You give them this particular passage, this, you know, particularly if they are adamant about reading the scripture, they're familiar with this particular passage. And so, again, when it comes to, you know, is it better to save a life or to kill it? Very strong words that really get to the heart of the matter. That's really what you're helping individuals to see, that this is really what you're doing. Is that, again, you know, rather than trying to get into arguments around, you know, whether if this is civil rights or not, is that really kind of getting to ways that they think and the ways they process. And again, this is not belittling anyone, but it's simply just saying there is a particular method to this. So one of the methods in which we have the Center for Lesbian Gay Studies, we have developed a variety of curriculums geared at various audiences. We have some, think of Bible studies, if you will, for Asian Pacific Islander audiences, Latino audiences, and the one that I've written is for African American audiences. It's called Umoja. Umoja is a Swahili word that means unity, and we talk about unity in the community. And I have these brochures that are listed. They're found out on the table out there, so you can take a look at what this are. But it's designed to help families and faith communities to talk about these issues in language in ways that are culturally relevant to them, that they begin to say, okay, I now see this. We've been having some spectacular successes throughout the state of California, working with congregations and other community leaders around this topic of inclusion. So we're very, very excited about that. So I know I'm pretty much at time, so let me pause there, and I know we I'll turn it back over to Lori. You might have some questions to ask.
The first is, and you can choose which one of you wants to take this one, do you think the narrow passage of Prop 8 is ultimately a good or bad thing in the struggle for marriage equality and gay rights?
Well, you know, I will say this. You know, I right after the Ninth Circuit Court's decision came out, I was watching television, and someone said, "You know, we're taking this all the way to the Supreme Court! Yay!" And you know, my reaction is that, you know, there are families, there are couples who need equality today. And so, again, the narrowness of the decision, I think, you know, is still playing it safe and not truly looking at, again, going back to that word, the heart of the matter, that these are people's lives that are dependent upon, you know, their spouse's inheritance, you know, if they pass or and so forth. And so rather than this being, to me, the way I look at it, as a political hot potato and just like, oh, we don't want to touch it. It's like that I believe how we begin to change the discourse is for individuals to really speak up, sharing their stories. The film does a spectacular job in doing that. So you can really, again, I just repeat, get to the heart of the matter.
Well, just to answer that specific question, I think the narrow ruling was actually a great way to go because it's only applicable to California. It may be applicable to Washington and Maryland because they may have initiatives that take back rights that the state's legislators have just given. But I think it is a terrific way to keep it in the public discourse as well. This last weekend, my family and I had the opportunity to be in L.A. at the premiere of 8, and we had George Clooney and Martin Sheen, and the list goes on about people who were in it. And to a person, I remember even Kevin Bacon saying, I don't live in this state. It's not anything I really ever spent time on. Of course, gay people should be able to get married. And just by being in the reading, the premiere of Prop 8 was actually taking that multi-day, multi-week trial, and it was made into an hour and a half reading. You can see it on the web now if you guys want to see it, if you haven't already. And it really creates an opportunity for people who wouldn't otherwise be aware of the issue to learn more about it, and in a very powerful way, hopefully in some ways that the film did as well.
Okay, and our second Prop 8 question is, Prop 8 and DOMA are not just expressions of prejudice, but tools of persecution, i.e. targeting a specific section of society. Can you explain to a married European why the wider American public tolerate this persecution when it wouldn't be tolerated on grounds of race or religion by the U.S. public?
That's a really good question.
There's a lot of things I can't explain to Europeans about how the United States does what it does. This is just among many of them. You know, I think that in many parts of Europe, particularly Western Europe, there's very much a live and let live attitude, the way parts of New England are here. And much of the rest of our country doesn't have that attitude. There's a lot about, in our whole regionalization, the way our country has developed, I think that people have become very selfish about wanting to be with people who are like them, with beliefs like them, and that's how our country has grown up. I mean, we could talk politics and talk socialism. I was listening to a story today about French parenting versus U.S. parenting on NPR, and why is it that it's such a big deal for a woman here to become pregnant and, you know, give up everything, you know, give up wine, give up fish, give up this, give up that. I'm going to be the perfect parent, and I'm going to feed my kid exactly this way, whereas in France, you know, the kid just joins in the parents and leads their life. And so I think in a lot of ways our country is actually parochial, and I think you see it here quite starkly, but I think there are lots of other parts of our lives where you see it as well.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I would just like to add one thing as an attachment to that, which is that I actually think that the cases that are coming forward related to DOMA are more significant than the marriage, than Prop 8 and other marriage. Not that I'm against those at all, but I just think those are huge. What's coming both on the West Coast, there are a few cases coming, and on the East Coast, there are a few cases coming. And there have already been recent rulings where DOMA has found to be unconstitutional. And that, to me, is the logjam, because, frankly, if we got marriage in all 50 states but we didn't overturn DOMA, we're really missing the prize.
Okay, for Roland, what do you say when you encounter somebody who just flatly says, you know, I'm homophobic? Well, they don't say they're homophobic, but, you know, who say it's their religion to justify homophobia?
Absolutely. Well, you know, again, I think it's always good to kind of, you know, choose your battles. But if I'm in a place where someone is willing to listen and to be open, then again, you know, I think the hearing where they are and specifically what their, you know, arguments are about why do they feel this way. You know, as was, you know, shown in Kathy's video, is that, you know, well, I think Leviticus says, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, is that, you know, there's a way to kind of answer it from a, you know, a theological, historical perspective. Sometimes it's more of an emotional, way of answering the question. So I think that's kind of the first way, you know, that I like to simply distinguish, you know, where is the person coming from? You know, because sometimes it is just simply, you know, I was taught this, and so, you know, and it has to be right, right? So great, let's go in that direction. Or it's something that, you know, there's just something more, you know, burning and bubbling in them, you know, or like I said, emotional. And so again, I can really talk about this a little bit more, but I see someone.
It's okay. We have permission.
Okay. So in any case,
can you wait 10 minutes, please?
No.
It is, and yeah. Please, I will deal with you in a few minutes.
So, in any case. I got a little distracted, but nonetheless, let me just maybe just end there because I just saw her in the back, and so I don't know if I quite answered the question, but it's hard for me to get back to it now. So
yeah, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Whoever asked the question, please see me afterwards. So.
Kathy, what's the next step to getting these powerful voices in front of the average citizen? Will these well-funded CEOs help get commercials made?
You know, the answer is possibly. When we did this film, we did it with the idea that we'd create a tool for people to be able to use in their personal networks. I don't really think it's about getting commercials made. I really think it's about bringing it to your local Rotary Club or your Commonwealth Club or your gym or your book club. We've had people show this at all kinds of small, large too, but small intimate groups with people who were either in their network or one or two levels removed. And I think it's much more powerful that way, actually, than it is in a commercial, because you're hearing personal voices. Later this week, in 2 months, the National Network of ALF is having their national conference, and it's going to be held in Burlingame. And there are 200 members in Silicon Valley, but there are thousands of members all over the country. And our hope, for example, is to be able to show this video and show other ALF leaders in other parts of the country that they could do this. These names may or may not mean anything to you because it's from Silicon Valley as opposed to San Francisco. But if you're in Atlanta, these names probably don't mean anything to you. But you could create the same film in Atlanta with visible leaders from Atlanta or from Phoenix or from New York. It's not that hard to do. And part of the message here was these are people that you know, that you work with, who run businesses, who run congregations, who make decisions in courts. These are powerful, influential, respected leaders in our Silicon Valley community, and this is what they have to say. And it's very powerful to share that with people who recognize their influence, the influence of the speakers here. So our intent really wasn't to have CEOs spend money to make commercials, but rather get average everyday citizens like us to be able to take it to places to foster a dialogue that sometimes is hard to get started. Like, you don't even know where to begin because you have so much, or I do anyway, so much emotion and so much passion about the topic that I could often unintentionally offend somebody. And by showing a film and letting just people reflect on it. And, you know, you, when you see the Vietnamese woman cry about her son going through puberty and feeling almost suicidal, and her daughter just, her straight daughter just skims through it, that's a very powerful message. Or when the Muslim woman is speaking about, wow, there are actually gay people in my religion. I never knew that. That speaks more to, I think, I don't know, a commercial where you don't even have the chance to dialogue with people. And in fact, if people have communities that they really are willing to commit to sharing it with, I would be happy to give you a copy of a DVD to do that. That's what the intent is.
Okay, I guess we will wind up at this point.
If I may just make one just final concluding comment, and is that you know, when it comes to strategizing, I think that's kind of what we've been talking about tonight, is different ways of reaching communities around this whole topic of equality. When it comes to faith and faith communities and religion, oftentimes we just, you know, get pshawed away, and just, you know, we definitely saw that a lot when during the Prop 8 campaign. And, No One Ate campaign. And so now that, you know, marriage equality is kind of in the courts, we're at this place where people are now turning their back on a strategy around faith communities. And I feel it's such a wrong thing, an error to make, because, again, at the heart of the opposition are religious people and sometimes religious arguments. And so I think it's wise to make sure that we're spending, you know, more time and thought around how to approach that. And I think, again, Kathy's video does a spectacular job having those various voices, you know, to get that. You know, oftentimes people, and I heard this a lot during the No One Ate campaign, it's like, well, you know what, you're naive, Roland. Because, you know, you're clinging to this faith of yours. You know, why be a part of an institution that is so against the LGBT community? And so, again, you know, for us to have that type of attitude, I think, you know, to say, you know, religion or clergy or faith communities are just, you know, unimportant. I believe, again, it's the wrong route to go, and it's really good to say, hey, how is it that we can be really smart around these types of strategies? And so that is the thing that we're hoping to do with Sacred Activism. And again, I'm sorry we're out of time, but I would love to talk further, and make sure to grab a brochure on your way out.
Okay, and we have one more question.
Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Let's see, Kathy, I think this one is in your, it's about, is a good employee.
Is a married employee a better employee? What effect will equal marriage rights have on the American economy and American business? Well, given that I heard we're almost out of time, I hesitate to begin to answer that question. I think what's the best employee is one who can bring them whole selves to work, and that they don't have to hide, and they don't have to feel at risk. And whatever that looks like, to allow employees to bring their full selves and their full passion and their full energy and be able to focus on the work at hand. You know, with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's kind of hard to get to the top if your basic needs of safety, security, food, housing are not taken care of. And for many LGBT people, they're not. Marriage is only one of those issues. There are many others that we could be talking about. So from my standpoint, until we can take care of the basic needs of all LGBT people, it makes it very difficult for them to be the best employee that they could be.
Fantastic. Our thanks to Kathy Levinson and Reverend Roland Stringfellow for their comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.